I just want to take a moment to pause and just say, so every Sunday morning, in order for you to sit there and be a part of this service, and for those to be up here or in the back or wherever, it takes quite a bit of work to make that happen. And it doesn't always go as planned, but can I just say, as I stood up here to the front, I don't know where it was coming from, but the sound of your singing was so overpowering that it is just a ministry to everyone here. So worship for us is not just pulling off a Sunday morning, but it is a moment to proclaim the goodness of God and to also be in a community with people that we are serving the risen Savior together. And that your involvement in worship is so powerful of what happens here on any given Sunday morning. So thank you for just your lungs, your voice, your passion, your praise. It makes a big difference for all of us. I want to continue. We're going to actually continue through September with Imagine Next, because there are so many things I want to talk to you about that there's no way to do it in just 1 month. I said this was going to be a four-week series, and now it's going to be an eight-week series. I also want to remind you that the whole purpose of Imagine Next was not to move us to the Imagine Next Fair and then to get more volunteers here. But instead, Imagine Next is a way of viewing life. It's a way of seeing the world. It's a way of engaging with the world. And quite honestly, if you don't engage in the world in this way, for me, the world is just a little bit more dull, a little less exciting, and many times a lot less exciting. And a lot of what we're talking about is that place in our faith where not only does God show up, but it is what makes our faith mean something. So we come to worship, we volunteer in different places, we go out and volunteer in the community, we tell somebody about Jesus. You know, you can do all of those things and do it and feel like you're doing a job or a task and have no sense that God is in any way involved and active within your life. But the thing that makes Christianity matter is the ability to be with Jesus, to become like him, and to do the things that he did. And so that moment of God working in you, and moments that you say, I don't know that I can do this, and all of a sudden you can, is an incredibly faith-building moment in which you realize this thing, this life in which we're living, is not just, it's not just the practicalities of getting from birth to death and try to have as much good time in between. It is partnering with God in a way that brings purpose to our lives and in a way that we know that he is real and he is active. And so the first week when we came together, we talked a little bit about just taking a voyage and not having to know the destination. One of the parts of imagining what could be, what should be, maybe what God might be calling you to, the part about imagination that is exciting is when you don't have a destination in mind, but instead you say, God, what do you want me to see? Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? And we talked about the voyage of Brendan, and the voyage of Brendan was, he set out to find the promised land. It ended up taking almost his entire life before he finally found the place in which he was looking. And he says to God, God, why have you taken this long to get me to the place that I set out to find? Why did you not get us here sooner? We endured storms. We endured sea monsters. We had to go through all of these terrible experiences. And God's response to him was, because I wanted you to see the wonders of the ocean. And there's a part of life that we feel needs to be as expedient from the goal to the completion as possible. But yet for God, that is not the way he sees life. And instead, it is a moment in which we get to experience him moving us and experiencing the wonders of the creation along the way. And so the journey really is a big part of what we are trying to do. The second week, we talked about the story of John, in which John had never been outside of his mountain home, his mountain community, had never been to the ocean until a friend went. A friend came back from the ocean and tried to describe the wonders of the ocean, and he just couldn't get it. He couldn't understand it. And so John went to visit the ocean, and it was in that moment that he could feel the breeze. He could feel the waves splash on his face. He could just look out at the wonder of how enormous the ocean is. And it was only by going for it and making the journey that he was able to experience something truly incredible and new and different for him. The third week, we talked about the call of Esther and that reluctant leaders are usually humble leaders, and humility is the fuel that God empowers. And so in our imagination, if you approach this whole process by saying, well, this is what I'm good at, and this is what I like, then you're probably going to miss out on God empowering you in ways that you're not good at something. And the reason that we don't do the things we're not good at is because we want to feel confident. We want to feel like it matters. We want people to look at us and think they've got their stuff together. But it's often humility that God empowers. And we saw that through the call of Esther. Last week we talked about the call of Peter, James, and John, where Jesus asked them to put out their shipping boat into the deep. And it was a call for us to seek God in the deep, not in the shallows, because that is often where He is found. And I shared with you that choosing to surrender and explore the depths is the call of Christ to see what He wants to do in you and the world through you. But there is an inescapable risk in following any of the things that we've talked about. And I want to talk to you about risk a little bit today. And as you leave, if there's something on your mind that feels risky, we might have you come talk to Bubba, who is not unfamiliar with risk. And if you don't know Bubba, you should look him up on YouTube and have a good afternoon with that. But there's going to be a risk that comes. And how we respond to that risk is often going to determine what we experience in life. And as Jesus is trying to teach His disciples, we have this incredible moment in which He deals with them on a very fear-based level, because risk for us can either involve a lot of excitement or a lot of fear, and probably at least a little bit of both. And one of the challenges with fear, the challenges of trying something new, the challenges of going outside your comfort zone, is that you just might fail. I mean, we should say that, right? If you've never failed, like, you're an amazing person, or you've never tried to do anything. But most of us have failed, and instead of failing and saying we just shouldn't try again, what we find is that the fear of failure is something that keeps you from some of the very best things in life, like whenever you asked out your spouse for the first time and you were really smitten and you thought they might say no, but you did it anyways, and they said yes. You took a risk. There was a chance when you started having kids, this might not go well, but you took a risk. Or maybe it was a career and you launched out and you're thinking, I'm in a job and my job pays my bills and it's comfortable, but I hate it. I don't think this is what God wants for me to do with my life. And now I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do, but I feel like I should do something else. But this is safe and I know what to expect. And yet some have taken the risk to try something new and they found something incredibly exciting in doing that. There's an inescapable risk in putting out to the deep. You could fail, you could suffer, you could be asked to sacrifice more than you're comfortable with. One of my favorite quotes on fear comes from the books or the movie, depending on your flavor, from Dune by Frank Herbert, who said, "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer." Someone remember this quote? Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. Fear is a normal part of life. It is a necessary part of life. It helps tell us when we need to stay away from something that is dangerous, but it also sometimes keeps us away from something that is incredibly exciting. I'm going to share a story that you're probably familiar with. You've probably heard it a number of times. I want to share it in a way that maybe you haven't heard it before. And I want us to explore what it may look like for you to approach your next if fear is involved. It comes from Matthew chapter 14, beginning with verse 22. This is the incredible story of Jesus walking on water. I just want to read it with you here to begin. By the way, this is following the death of John the Baptist. Jesus has just fed the 5,000. And then we enter into this moment. It says, "Immediately He made the disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side while He dismissed the crowds. And after He had dismissed the crowds, He went up on the mountain by Himself to pray. And when evening came, He was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, He came to them, walking on the sea. Let me just stop there for a minute and let's just paint the picture for what is happening. The disciples have gotten into the boat. It's sometime early in the day, and they are rowing out to the place in which that they're going to meet Jesus. Jesus stays behind and he prays and he steals away to himself, which he oftentimes does. And he spends a good amount of time there until everyone has left. No one is there again. And in the fourth watch, 6 to 8 hours later, Jesus decides to go out and find the disciples. He doesn't have a boat. They have at this point been rowing most of the day and they are tired. And we know why they're tired, and that's because the winds are blowing and the storms have come up and the waters have become difficult and they're not making any progress, but they've got to get to the place that they're going. They can't stay out there in the water, and so they have to keep going. For some of us, our Imagine Next involves things that are not going to happen quickly. Many years ago, my brother-in-law and I were at the beach, and we rented a couple of kayaks, and we decided it would be fun to put in one of the little causeways behind the beachfront, and that we were going to row our way out into the ocean. And we thought this was an amazing idea and an amazing opportunity. Neither one of us kayaked, so we had no idea what to expect. And what we discovered is that if you have waves rushing in to the land, and then you have a little area in which it's now irrigating all these causeways, there's a pretty incredible amount of current that's going to push that way. And so if you're inland and you want to go out into the ocean, you have to go against that current. And I will just tell you, it's somewhat of a minor miracle that my brother-in-law and I lived. Because we got out in these smooth waters and we were making headway and we were like, yeah, we can do this. We also just like a challenge and we don't really care how hard it's going to be. I enjoy doing things that you're not supposed to do. I like taking risks. And so we did that. And about halfway out, we were stuck. And we had been rowing probably 30, 45 minutes. And we weren't making any progress. And the water was high and the waves were choppy and the kayak would just dip. And we weren't serious kayakers. You know, serious kayakers have this thing that keep water out of your kayak. We didn't have any of that. We were recreational. Water's flooding into our kayak and we're trying to get somewhere. It's too far from either side. We don't want to go back because, I mean, we're young guys and we have egos. So we couldn't go back. So we just kept going forward. Eventually, my brother-in-law lost his paddle, and so I paddled over to get his paddle, and then he went over. I was like, well, I'm going to have to go rescue him, because I didn't fall over. So I go over, and I grab his paddle, and I start paddling to him, and then I lost my paddle. And then you can imagine what happened next. I went over. And here we are. Now, you would think that a responsible kayaker would wear what? Not young guys. We don't need a kayak. I mean, we don't need a life vest. And so quite honestly, for both of us, we're tired. We've been paddling for a while. We were ready to quit. And here we are now fighting for our life, and these waves are lapping over us. Fortunately, a couple of guys in some Ski-Doos came by and grabbed our kayaks, grabbed our paddles, grabbed us, and brought us over to the shore. And I don't remember what they said. They probably said something like, have you guys ever done this before? And I probably said, oh yeah, I don't know what happened. You know, I don't know. But there's been a lot of things in my life that has felt just like me trying to get out to the ocean, and which I'm paddling and I'm giving it everything I have, and I feel like I'm not going anywhere. And there's a lot of times that you follow your imagination and where God is trying to lead you, you're going to feel like you're paddling out to the ocean and you're not going anywhere. And oh, there goes my paddle. That's why there's a whole lot of people who will not imagine for something amazing. Because they don't want to be disappointed. And they don't want to deal with the hard things. One of the things that I want to mark our church, and I believe it does, is that we are a church of people who have courage. Because courage is often in short supply. And in the church, it's easy to feel like, people don't like us, or we're getting criticized, or nobody wants to go to church, or things like that. And we can just easily say, this is too much work, and this is too hard, and let's just stop doing it. In fact, over the last 10, 15 years, that's happened in mass. We've seen it over and over and over again. See, it's in this environment in which Jesus is about to teach his disciples an incredible lesson, because their starting the church is way harder than us getting ready and coming to church today. And so as they're paddling out, Jesus decides he's going to go out and he's going to meet them. So again, verse 25, in the fourth watch on the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were afraid or terrified and said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. He said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. I just want us to remember, Peter is walking on water at this point. It is happening. He's doing the very thing that Jesus himself is doing. He is doing the things that Jesus did. Verse 8, he said, come. So Peter got out of the... 29. He said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. And Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. Now, amazingly, this passage of Scripture is one that many of us use to avoid doing hard things. And we avoid doing hard things because, I mean, if Peter couldn't do it, how could I? And we also misunderstand what Jesus is trying to say here, and we'll say something to the effect of, well, if Peter just had more faith, he could have kept walking. Well, I don't feel like I have that kind of faith to walk on water. I've tried it. It didn't work. And we give ourselves an out by saying, you've got to have such an immense amount of faith to do the things that God has said. I just won't try. That is not the message of this story. The message of this story is not, well, if you just had more faith, you'd be better at what you're doing. If you just had more faith, you'd be better at leading youth ministry or kids ministry or worship or teaching or whatever it is that you do in your ministry, serving with Widow's Harvest or however else you serve outside of these walls. If I just had more faith, well, I mean, if Peter didn't have enough faith, and let's be honest, Peter's got a pretty sketchy track record through the New Testament. Of all of the disciples, I identify most with him because he's the one that we have his screw-ups written down the most. So we have this in which he sank. I mean, we really don't give him credit that he actually walked. We know that he's going to deny Jesus three times. We also know that Paul's going to have to put him back on the right path because he starts eating with all the popular people and he starts avoiding all the people Jesus wanted him to minister to. But see, I can relate to Peter because of all of the failures that I have in my life. Maybe you can relate to Peter as well. But this story is not really about Peter. It is about walking on water, but not in the way that you think. This story is really all about the environment in which they find themselves, which is the environment in which you often find yourself, and that is in chaotic waters. Problem waters. Here's where I encourage you, and this is why we spend so much time in the Old Testament. You cannot consider yourself a student of the New Testament if you are not a student of the Old Testament. You cannot say, let me say it again, that you were a student of the New Testament if you were not a student of the Old Testament, because the New Testament, in many ways, is just trying to reframe what we got wrong from the Old Testament. It is the fulfillment of all the things that are happening in the Old Testament that help us understand anything that's happening in the New. And the reason we read this story, we think it's strictly about walking on water, is because we don't understand the significance of water throughout the Old Testament. And I'm just telling you that this story about Peter is a story about you. And if you understand what it's saying, then maybe you will have some courage to go out and do the thing that's bubbling up in your imagination, but you're still thinking that may cost too much, that may hurt too much, it may fail. Because those are all very real possibilities that will happen. If we go back to the book of Genesis, two of my favorite resources, if you're looking to really dive into Scripture, one is our Bema podcast, not ours. We have a group that goes through the Bema podcast. It's Marty Solomon. I'm a big fan of it. I'm also, as you know, a big fan of the Bible Project and Tim Mackey. And I remember Tim Mackey saying once, the entire Bible can be told in the first three chapters of Genesis. The whole rest of the Bible is really just the first three chapters of Genesis told in lots of different ways. I don't know, Marty probably said that too. So we go back to Genesis chapter 1 and we go to the very beginning of creation. What we find is at the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the what? The what? The deep or the waters? It says deep. Depending on your translation. The face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. This is our first introduction into chaotic waters. The earth was chaotic. The earth was without order. The earth was formless and void. The creation had not been formed in the way in which we understand it yet. And yet God was there over the surface of the waters. Can you think of any other stories in the Old Testament that heavily rely on water as one of the characters of the story? Noah's Ark. Parting the Red Sea. Jonah and the whale. I mean, there's a ton of them. And in those stories, the water is not just the environment in which the story takes place. The water is a character of the story. If we read through other places within Scriptures, what we're going to find is that when God began to create, the first thing that He did was He separated the land. One of the first things was separated the land from the water. In almost every mythological story, when you find where the gods live, if we don't say heaven, where do the gods live? Think about it. In almost every story about the gods, do they live down in the valley? Do they live out on the fields? Do they live amongst everyone else? They live up on a mountain somewhere. Almost every story we have of the gods, where are they? They're up there somewhere. And in the story of creation, it's an incredible part of this story in which God is separating those places, in which there seems to be a separation of the chaos and this place up on the mountain. If we go and we read through Revelation, what we're going to find is that when heaven finally comes to earth, because our understanding of heaven is usually wrong, as this place where our soul goes and we're out floating amongst the clouds somewhere. But Revelation says that there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth where heaven comes down and the two overlap, and heaven's going to be here in some way. But heaven is always described as kind of this mountain garden city, because a garden is one of the primary metaphors that Scripture uses to talk about where God is. Garden of Eden, the call back to the garden, the tabernacle, then the temple. When you walked in, it looked like a garden. But there's a difference throughout Scriptures between these high places and these chaotic waters. In Isaiah chapter 17, it says this, "Ah, the thunder of many peoples, they thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of nations, they roar like the roaring of mighty waters." Verse 13 says, "The nations roar like the roaring of many waters, but He will rebuke them." Rebuke who? What's He rebuking here? Is He rebuking the nations, or is He rebuking the waters? Which is He rebuking? "And they will flee far away, chased like chaff on the mountains before the wind, and whirling dust before the storm. At evening time, behold terror. Before morning, they are no more. This is the portion of those who loot us, and the lot of those who plunder us." Psalm chapter 65, verse 5 says this, "By awesome deeds you answer us with righteousness, O God of our salvation, the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the farthest seas." Verse 6 says, "The one who by his strength established the mountains, being girded with might, who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, the tumult of the peoples, so that those who dwell at the ends of the earth are in awe at your signs. You make the going out in the morning and the evening to shout for joy." Now there's a whole bunch of other places, especially in Psalms. There's a whole lot of other places throughout the Old Testament in which we find these waters being associated with bad things. The Bible uses a lot of metaphors for lots of different things, but one of the primary metaphors that it uses and one of the primary metaphors in this story is that the chaotic waters in which the disciples find themselves are a combination of hardship, just how bad life can get, and is often also associated with their enemies. These nations. When I ask you, who was God rebuking, the waters or the nations? Both. Because the waters represent those nations trying to destroy Israel. The chaotic waters are something that are not just an environment in which the story happens, but instead it is a character of the story that you will find yourself, and that is when life gets hard. Because life does get hard. And so this story is not so much about a story just of faith, but it's a story of Jesus teaching the disciples that you can have mastery over the chaotic waters in your life. The story of Jesus walking on water would have been a powerful metaphor for the disciples to see that Jesus is God and he has power over chaos, our enemies, and the struggles that we will inevitably face as we follow him. That is what this story is about. When Jesus invites Peter out of the boat, he's inviting him to express this mastery too. In John chapter 14, verse 12, we're going to find later that Jesus is going to say about you that you are going to demonstrate some of the same powers that God himself demonstrated through Christ. And that's a sticky place, and it's something we avoid because we don't want to be disappointed, and we're not exactly sure which of those powers he's really talking about. I really don't want the power of being resurrected after being nailed to a cross. I don't want that. But he says this in John 14, 12 through 14, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do, because I'm going to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, this I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it." This is an incredible invitation for us. Like, I want to work through you, and I want to do something amazing through you, if you will choose to follow. But we also have this interesting, different take in the Gospel of Mark on this story that Matthew doesn't include. We know this is a significant story that the disciples needed to communicate to others because it's found in every one of the Gospels. But this is how Mark describes this moment, which gives us another glimpse of what Jesus is trying to do as he's walking on water. Mark chapter 6, beginning with verse 48, it says, "And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea." And then Mark says this. He says, "He meant to pass by them." Now that is really a strange part of the story. Why would Jesus intend to walk out there and be like, you know, not stop? Why would he do that? And what we find in this story, again, as we look back through the Old Testament, is we find there are some incredibly important moments in which God passes by, and when he passes by, it's not simply because he's got somewhere to be. I just want to beat them there. I'm going to get the campfire started. I'm going to throw a line in to get some more fish for dinner, because we are, or maybe he's carrying a big basket of leftovers from feeding the 5,000. I don't know. Why would Jesus want to pass by them? There's a word that we use to describe events in which God intersects the lives of people in a tangible, visible way. We call it a theophany. A theophany is when God shows himself in the way that you can see or experience him in a more tangible way than simply through our hearts, through our souls, through our prayer. Two of these incredibly important moments that we find are the story of Moses on Mount Sinai when he has gone up to receive the tablets and God says, "You cannot look at me. Anyone who looks at me or looks on me cannot live. They will die." And so he covers his face as God walks by. And if you'll remember, this is the moment in which Moses begins to glow simply by being in the shadow of the presence of God. Something that he would wear a veil for a while in order for people not to notice that it passed. An incredibly important moment. A second moment like this is the story of Elijah on Mount Horeb. After he's defeated the prophets of Baal and he's running from Jezebel, Elijah becomes despondent and he retreats. And God says, "I'm going to pass by." This is one of those incredible moments, and many of us can relate to this story because God doesn't pass by in any of the ways in which he expected. At first, there was a strong wind, but God was not there. Then there was an earthquake, but God was not there. And then there was a fire, but God was not there. But finally, God was where? Do you remember the story? He was in a gentle whisper. And he also had to turn away, because he couldn't behold God in all of his glory. But you'd imagine this story is another one of these theophanies in which the disciples are going to recognize Jesus is God. And Jesus wants this to be a significant moment in their lives. One in which he demonstrates that you are going to live a life in chaotic waters, but God has mastery over them. And so the call to Peter is the call to us. And knowing that, will we take a step? Will we go and try? Will we take risks? One of my frustrations with the American way, which don't get me wrong, I like a lot of things about America. One of my frustrations with the American way is the pursuit of happiness. Now, why would I have a problem with that? I mean, who doesn't want to pursue happiness? And the reason I have a problem with the pursuit of happiness is not the pursuit of being content or joyful or happy, but yet it is how we define what happiness is. And happiness in America often looks like, I'm going to work real hard and work real hard and work real hard until I can eat, drink, and be merry for the rest of my life. We are so over-entertained. We are so distracted. We have so many things going on in our lives, all in a desire to be as comfortable as possible. We want to be comfortable. And don't get me wrong, I don't like being uncomfortable. But a lot of times the way this works out in our lives is that we avoid risk. We don't want to have anything that will threaten our peace or our comfort or whatever. We end up filling our times with the things that make us comfortable, which are often entertainment or food or just sitting around or, you know, I just don't do things anymore. Eventually, there'll be some threat to our peace, and we won't be able to handle it, because a reality of human nature is that if you avoid risk at all chance, when something bad happens, you don't generally have the tools within you to deal with them. And then we just run like crazy from anything that may cost us something. We just can't handle stress. We live in a time where people are more anxious now than they perhaps have ever been. And I believe one of the reasons is because we have sought comfort and we have not lived intentional lives of purpose. It doesn't take long to realize that life is fraught with all kinds of chaotic waters. I'm going to say this wrong, this name wrong, but I came across this quote by a wealthy Indian entrepreneur and investor. His name is Naval Ravikant. And he said, the more you seek comfort, the more uncomfortable you become. And in part, I believe that's because the more we seek comfort, the less discomfort we can stand. When we look at the apostles and we look at the lives that they lived, they were with Jesus, they were following Jesus, they were doing the things that Jesus did. But you know, one thing that they didn't rest on was comfort. Their lives ended violently. Jesus would say when he would call them, I don't have a place to rest my head. Comfort is not a part of our life goals. We have purpose and we have intention. I want to encourage you in this, that the call to step out of the boat is still to you, just like it was to Peter. And the call is into the chaotic waters, just as it was for Peter. And yet Jesus has the ability to calm the waters, whatever they are, and he's giving that ability to us. It does not mean that life does not have hard things, but they don't have control of us the way they do for others. Take a step. Sometimes that step is a hard step. And I tell you that for Deidre and I, we're entering into a new season of life in which Emma's here today, but mostly now it's me and Deidre and Malia. We've gone from 6 to 3, and so we have decided that we want our house to be a house for adults again. Those of you with young children know what that means. You put things away, they stay put away. There's a fraction of the laundry to do. The food budget goes way down. And so we've decided there are things that we neglected around the house that need to be done. And I'm a big picture person. I like to go for the big thing. Let's just throw a dagger in the jugular of whatever the thing is that needs to be done. But sometimes you don't need to go for the jugular. You need to do other things first. So one of the things we're looking at is painting the house. I was sharing with my mom, we wanted to paint the house inside a lot lighter color than we have. We've never hired a painter. We always do our own painting, so it's a big task. Mom said, yeah, I hear that happens a lot when you get older because you can't see as well. You want to paint your house a lighter color. I said, thanks, Mom. That was very encouraging. But no, that's not why we're painting it a lighter color. And so I've gone to all the paint stores and gotten all the samples and I've brought them home. I don't know when we're going to have time to do this, but we're going to do it. And I'm ready to make a commitment. I'm ready to buy the paint. I'm ready to get started. And what you should know is that I haven't parked my car in our garage in about a year because of all the junk in the garage. So I texted Deidre and I said, hey, what do you think about this color? Can we just clean out the garage first? Is her response. Deidre has a lot of wisdom. Sure, but pick a color, is my response. So she and her sister turned 50. It's one of those milestones you never want to hit, but once you hit it, you realize it's not that bad. And she's gone to the beach with her sister, and so I had big plans. So it was just going to be me, and I was going to get the house ready to paint. But what I needed to do was not go buy paint, not even pick out a color. What I needed to do was to get rid of a bunch of junk. Can I get an amen? Some of you are going to go home and look around and realize you've got a lot of junk to get rid of too. And so yesterday, I have one place that I most don't want to work on. It's the little side table to my bed. And it's where everything goes that I should not forget and everything that I want to remember and then knickknacks and everything. Yeah, don't hit your neighbor. It's just full of junk. I mean, it's the kind that I can't even fully close the drawer, not because of the stuff that's in the drawer, but the stuff that has overflowed the drawer and is now behind the drawer. And so you can't close the drawer fully. On top of that, it has all... You've got one of those too, I can tell.
No.
And so I thought, I'm going to knock out this one, because part of it is also a lot of nostalgic things are in there, and I'm trying to get rid of stuff, and the hardest thing to get rid of is nostalgic stuff. So I spend the entire day on a small table. It allowed me to clear off the top of it, and it's not been this clean in I don't know how long. And my dresser, which for the first time you can see, it's a wood dresser and it has a wood top. You would have thought it was made of books or papers or mail or stuff like that. You can actually see the top. Can I tell you, I woke up this morning going, my side table is clean. Now you laugh, and you think that's silly, and Mark, you need a life, and I probably do. However, that was the step I needed to take, not picking out paint colors. And that has freed me up to now think about all the other things that need to happen, which next is my closet, and then the garage. Let me tell you how I function, and this is how some of you function when it comes to imagining your next. I think big picture. I think about the thing that needs to be accomplished. I'm going to go do the big thing, and I'm going to make it happen, and you're going to walk in and go, wow, look at what Mark did. I could have cleaned out that side table any time before now. But it was the step I didn't want to take. But it was the step that needed to be taken first. And for some of you, you don't need to do the big thing just yet, because God is still forming that in you. You just need to take the step. And for some of you, it's the one you don't want to take. For some of us, that might mean margin. You're just doing too much. You are too caught up on Netflix, right? Like, if you're searching through, seen it, seen it, seen it, seen it, seen it, seen it, seen it. What else? I got to find something to watch. Seen it, seen it, seen it. Don't want to watch that. Seen it. Then you probably need to cancel Netflix. I'm going to be honest. I know, I'm meddling now. What is the step? Part of the reason Deidre and I are doing this is because Deidre and I are being a lot more intentional about our lives at this season. Where do we spend our time? Where do we invest our efforts? Where do we feel God is moving us the most? And it may sound silly, but I know you feel this. When our house is a mess, I feel like our lives are a mess. And so we can clean up that mess so that it's not on our minds when we're thinking about the thing God is moving us towards. I encourage you, perhaps today you need to take a step or make a decision, or you need to create some margin, or you've been thinking about this big thing, but really what you need to do is this one little thing right now. The story of Jesus walking on water would have been a powerful metaphor for the disciples to see that Jesus is God and he has power over chaos, our enemies, and the struggles that we will inevitably face as we follow him. I want to continue to invite you that we boldly, courageously, confidently seek the things that God is calling us to. And in so doing, bless all the nations of the world. Would you pray with me?